Welcome to the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy Dowling, and this week's guest is Rusty Young, the international best-selling author. You probably remember his first book, Marching Powder, where he had a four-month voluntary stay at San Pedro prison in Bolivia. He met a convicted drug smuggler called Thomas McFadden, who was running tour groups through the prison. Now, you might think that's unusual, but this prison is unusual. So do yourself a favor, check out that book. I read it 10 plus years ago, and it's still one of the best books I've ever read. So I cannot recommend this book enough. Please go out and check it. It's an international bestseller. Most bookstores you walk into these days will still have a copy on the shelves, even after all these years, and no doubt it'll grace the shelves for years to come. Now, Rusty's just released a new book called Colombiano, which is about child soldiers in Colombia, and it's focused around one young boy named Pedro who, well, I'm halfway through the book now, and I really don't want to spoil it because I do not know how to describe a book without spoiling it. So I'll let Rusty explain it in this chat. We caught up over in North Sydney a few weeks ago. He was just towards the end of his Australian book launch, where he'd been going around the country and doing book appearances, signing books, and talking about the latest book, Colombiano. And so I managed to get a hold of him, went out to his place in North Sydney, and we had a chat for an hour or so and just spoke about, well, how the hell he got to South America, what compelled him to go and hang out in a prison, and probably one of the most dangerous prisons in the world, for several months, and then write this amazing book and then stay in South America for quite a few years. He ended up moving to Colombia for 8 years afterwards, wrote Marching Powder, and then continued to start writing this new book. He's worked with counterterrorism contractors, US contractors in Colombia. He is so ingrained into this whole world, it's quite intimidating, and he has got some really crazy stories. A lot of this stuff's highlighted in his books. There's a lot of stuff online as well, which I'll put over on the show notes on andysocial.net, some really cool videos, so make sure you go there and check it out. There's also a documentary that's coming out soon called Wildlands. I don't know the release date. It's been pushed back a few times. I'm not sure whether Rusty mentioned it in this episode or not. We did speak a little bit afterwards, but there were a couple of reasons for delaying the release of the documentary, and it was a little bit sensitive and involved some governments in other countries. So I'll leave it at that, just in case he mentions it or just in case I'm not allowed to mention it. But there's a trailer for Wildlands, which I'll put on andysocial.net, so make sure you go over there and check it out. It's really, really cool. So enough of me. This is a really great chat. So fortunate to be able to sit down with Rusty and have a great chat with him. And I'm looking forward to catching up with him later on down the track, especially when Wildlands is out and it's had a bit of airtime and people get to know it. I'd really love to pick his brain and learn more about that whole other chapter in his life. But wow, what a guy. All right, guys, enjoy this episode with international best-selling author Rusty Young.
Thanks, Andy, for having me on your podcast.
We made it happen.
We're here.
It's been a few months in the making. You've had a couple of things on.
Yeah, so I've been on a national tour of five states of Australia, and very tired, but glad to be here with you, mate.
You've got a couple of cities still to go.
Yeah, I've got Melbourne Writers Festival Sunday week, and I've got four more Sydney events. So It's been really, really busy. Lots of television, absolutely. Radio. It's been a real whirlwind, but very happy with the launch for Colombiano.
Oh, I've been indirectly stalking you because
really, I'm flattered. You're trying to cheat yourself, man. On Grindr or
sorry. Well, I was up in Brisbane first weekend of August, and you were up there doing your book launches there. Yeah. I'm in Melbourne next weekend.
Okay.
And then I thought, no, I'll just wait until that period that you're in Sydney, because I was going to go, oh, by the way, while you're up there. But I thought I'd just go off on a bit of a tangent to begin with.
Sure. Now, that's the best start, a tangent.
It is. And we'll have plenty of them. Now, I got your book. Uh-huh. And I've only just started reading it, so okay. I'm only a couple of chapters in. But
just read the back cover, man. That's the best part.
No, don't worry about the rest of it. I put a picture up on Instagram, and then a dear friend of mine contacted me and said, I went to school with that guy. Now, he's a few years younger than you, right. So you might not recall him, and I'll give you his full name later, but my mate Dan, he sent me this message, and then he went through some books and found this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was from That was my 1990 Tools 2 school photo, yeah. Yeah. Scott's. That's hilarious. Debating team. Great hair. I was a little kid. I was 17 there. Yeah, wow.
I tell you what, pretty ambitious for that age. You were certainly heavily involved in a number of different things.
Yeah, I think I put my career aspiration as a playwright, didn't I?
You did, yeah. 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 Have you done that yet?
No, that was my initial. So I started writing when I was about 12 at Scots College. Had a really good English teacher in year 7 called Michael Boylan, and he used to encourage us to write a journal, a diary. And then he would read it. If you wanted him to read it, he would read it. If you said don't read it, then he'd just check to see that you wrote it. And he used to write back to me. He said, hey, he said, kid, you've got some talent. You could be a writer. And this is when I'm 12. So that was really what set me off on the writing path. And I really loved the power and the immediacy of plays, of drama. I thought it was so much more, a much more powerful medium than television. Mm. And I wrote short stories. I was reasonable at English at school. But being a playwright was my initial ambition. I think it's a really difficult thing to do, and certainly difficult career path to have, particularly, in Australia where the market is relatively small. Books are fantastic because you can write it and sell it all over the world.
Mm.
And, I've been pretty fortunate enough with my first book that it's sort of, I'm not a millionaire, but I it's allowed me to keep writing. That's what I love doing most in the world is writing and traveling.
That's cool. And is there still an underlying desire to do playwright?
Look, I haven't come back to it. You've just reminded me of that. I don't know if I've got the skill. There's different. People assume that if you're good at one type of writing that you're going to be good at another. So, for example, people say, why don't you adapt your first book into the... Why don't you write the screenplay? And writing a screenplay is, they're words, the same as a novel, same as a non-fiction journalistic piece, but it's a very different skill set to be a playwright. I would consider it if I had, once I'm through this hectic period, I'd need to reassess where I'm going next. So, you've reminded me. I like to fulfill my ambitions and set goals for myself, and that was the goal I set at the age of 17, and I haven't fulfilled that one.
Well, I mean, you have a few excuses as to why that hasn't been done yet, but gone off on a couple of other tangents. I've got a number of questions to ask you about writing and whatnot, and I'll get to that. At some stage down the track, but you're one of the first guests that I've had on where I've explained or I've been telling friends and whatnot and saying who I've got coming up on the podcast, and you're the only person where I haven't needed to explain who you are.
Oh, really?
Especially when I just rattle off and I say Marching Powder and they're like, oh, that guy, oh my God. Everyone else, it's like even probably someone who you would think most people would know, such as like Tony Barber, an old Australian icon.
Yeah.
Some of the younger guys are like, who?
Who's this? He was like Sailor of the Century, right?
Yeah. And but for yourself, there was no extra explanation. It was like, oh, that's going to be great. So
fantastic.
However, I will note
there's a caveat here.
No. Well, I do have a number of listeners, not from Australia, but all over the world. I've got a large listener base in Japan for whatever reason.
How did you get that?
I think it might be, we played in Japan quite a few years, quite a few times over the years, and I think that's just sort of leveraged off that, but I don't know what's actually sparked it.
Right.
I've tried to go through Google and other channels to see where my links are being posted, but cannot locate anything. But I've got some friends over there, and I think it's just going through some circles over there. But I think maybe just not to spend a lot of time on it, because I'm sure you've gone into autopilot many times over the years explaining some of the background behind some of your...
We can do it quickly. We can do a quick rundown.
We'll do a snapshot.
Of Marching Powder.
Yeah. So I guess maybe just to understand a bit of the context behind it, and then some of the motivations to even go to that part of the world in the first place.
Yeah, sure. Yep. So I was a law student. I had a fairly privileged upbringing. Parents are still together, wonderful, supportive family, beautiful younger sister, 2 years younger. And I went to a private school, went to university. I studied commerce law, so I was sort of set towards going along a corporate career path. But I also loved traveling. My parents took me traveling a lot when we were kids, and I also traveled all throughout university. And I always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't feel I had that much to say. So I was always go writing, and that would always inspire me. Just the different languages, different cultures, different sights, smells, sounds. And so I was kind of writing emails, and this is probably the precursor to blogging, lots of travel blogs, but back in the day there weren't blogs, there wasn't Facebook, there wasn't Instagram. And I would just go writing, and I'd write up short stories and email it out, and people would, forward it on to their friends. And Basically, I was just testing the waters to see if I could write, to see whether I could write anything interesting, to see whether people would like it. And then I stumbled across this prison. I was traveling with my then girlfriend, Simone Camilleri. She was my girlfriend for 5 years at university. We finished law together. And we just decided to go traveling before, you know, settling down to do a corporate job. We did sort of 6 months or so in South America. And on our last day in Bolivia, we heard of, well, we went to this prison. We'd heard about it for weeks in advance. People had been talking about it all along what's called the Gringo Trail in South America. And it was listed in the guidebooks as the world's most bizarre tourist attraction. In fact, they were sort of saying, if you're adventurous, go into this prison. Now, the guidebooks are saying the opposite. They don't. It's unethical. But back in the day, that was the thing that you did. And so we left our passports at the gate. We asked for a guy called Thomas. Thomas McFadden was an African-born British drug trafficker, drug smuggler who'd been caught with 5 kilograms trying to leave El Alto Airport in La Paz, Bolivia. And he was incarcerated in San Pedro. So in San Pedro, it really is a crazy penitentiary system. Inmates don't wear uniforms. They have the keys to their own rooms, which are not really cells. Every single cell is different. It's more like a ramshackle village. There are 8 different sections inside this prison, and you have to buy your own prison cell. So depending on what your budget is, you can live a luxurious lifestyle in the 5 or 6-star section. I mean, it's not quite like a 6-star hotel, but
in comparison.
By comparison, yeah, for a prison. I mean, they had internet. One guy had a jacuzzi. The wealthiest guy who had 4.2 tons of cocaine in his own airplane, he had a 2-story apartment with a view over the city, glass windows, ensuite bathroom, computers. It was just, it's carpeted floors, incredibly independent capitalistic kind of system in there. And unfortunately, at the opposite end, there's the 0 and 1-star sections where inmates, many of them have drug problems. They don't have money in the first place. They're petty street criminals. They can't afford a good cell, so they live in the poor sections and stacked 3 or 4 inside, one on top of each other, basically, like in a ship's hold,
Yeah. Right.
We went in there. We did a one-hour tour. It cost $5 at the time. Half of the money went to Thomas McFadden and his bodyguards. The other half went to the corrupt guards. So the guards were making a lot of money out of this. Thomas had at the peak of the tours, between 50 and 70 visitors going through each day. The average tour group size was 15 people. So we went around, checked out all the prisoners, met the prisoners' wives and children also live in there. So it's a fully functional male prison. But inmates are allowed to bring their girlfriends, their wives, their kids, their cats, their dogs in there. It's really colourful. As I said before, they don't wear uniforms, so it's pretty difficult to tell the visitors from the inmates.
Wow.
And there are, because the state doesn't give them much food, they only give them like a bowl of watery soup every day, there are restaurants inside there. So the inmates bring in their own food, they cook inside their cells, and the guards don't go inside. So the inmates run the entire prison themselves.
So for some of them, it'd probably be better for them inside than it is outside.
Yeah, if you have money, you could you could certainly live better, or have a decent lifestyle. You've also got to remember, it's still a prison. So no matter how luxurious, if you can't leave those four walls, it's still a prison. It does, at first it seems like a bit like a hotel. There's drugs, there's alcohol, you can get girls in, whatever. But at the end of the day, it's still a prison, and at night time, it actually becomes quite dangerous. So there's really two faces to this prison. There's the village, the South American village during the day, women in their colourful skirts. Bolivians are they're such a colourful, beautiful, pure culture. And then at night time, a lot of the middle class sections, let's call them, lock their gates, because at night time is when all the people start smoking cocaine base, which is similar to crack cocaine, and then they really start to go a little bit crazy. Alcohol, drugs, violence, they'll be up all night partying. So we actually did the one-hour tour. He took us back to his prison cell and we started talking, and his stories were just so amazing. I've never heard anything like this. He's not highly educated, so I was like, you should write a book. And he's like, I'm not a very good writer. And Simone said, look, Rusty is a good writer, but he hasn't got a story. So I was a writer who didn't have a story, and he had a story and he needed a writer. So that was kind of how we met.
Yeah. That's, I think, going through that tour, did you ever feel a sense of, apprehension, or feel that you were at risk or anything like that? Or was Thomas just sort of making it sort of feel that it was a comfortable environment? I mean, you mentioned there's two sides to the prison, day and night.
So the first thing is, you know, he's a really engaging person. He looks you in the eye, shakes your hand, he remembered everyone's name. He's got a beautiful voice. He's just a charming individual, not at all like what my preconception of drug traffickers was. I was thinking he's going to be like a hard, untrustworthy, you know, violent criminal, but he's not. He also had a bodyguard with him, which that was an unnecessary, but it was a precaution that made you feel a lot safer. So this big sort of 6'3" guy following us around. He'd been stabbed 5 times. No one was messing with him. He'd survived being stabbed 5 times through the gut. And so there was no danger. You know, the tourists were bringing a lot of money into the prison economy, and they need money circulating inside there to survive. So providing the tourists were respectful, they weren't allowed to bring cameras, providing they're respectful, they would spend money at the restaurants, they would buy handicrafts, buy medicine for the inmates, blankets, you know, give the kids colouring in kits. So for providing, you know, it was done respectfully, the inmates were really very, very you know, very calm, and there was no danger at all.
Welcoming of it.
Yeah, very well. Well, some of them didn't like it, but they just stayed out of the way, right?
Yeah.
At nighttime, as I said, that was a different place. So most tourists who went in there only went in for the 1 hour tour. The visitor's bell rang, and he said, "Well, it's nice meeting you. You got to go." And I'm like, "Oh, I don't want to go. Like, this is the most amazing thing ever." And he's like, "Well, if you give me an extra $5 each, you can spend the night." And I looked at my girlfriend, and she's like, "I'm staying." And I'm like, "You can't stay. You're, you know, attractive 24-year-old girl." And she's like, "Well, you're staying. I'm staying." And so we ended up staying 2 nights in the prison, and we'd had quite a few beers by the end of the second night. And I nodded off, and I woke up, and when I woke, there Simone and Thomas said, "Guess what? You're writing a book." And I went, "Okay, cool." And I did.
So was it a case of going away and sort of working out the logistics behind and then coming back in? Because you were there for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, so that was the first 2 nights. And then there was 6 months break before I went back because, you know, we had planned a tour and I wasn't going to suddenly stop traveling with my girlfriend just because I wanted to write a book. It was like, I need some time to think about this. We stayed in contact. We kept traveling through Peru and Ecuador, came back to Australia. I worked for 6 months in the legal industry. And, you know, by that stage, I was, you know, you're back in comfortable Sydney, sun shining. I'm like, why would I, you know, it started to seem a bit like a bit of a dream, like that was a crazy place. Do I really want to do this with my life? Give up a good job, you know, an office career. And I was like, actually, yeah, I do. I think I would have ended up suicidal if I'd stayed in, you know, corporate world. So I went back, and then at that stage, there was no definite time period in mind. It was just go back and do the research, stay in the prison for a while. And I was thinking, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, but it actually ended up being 4 months because Thomas had another legal case. So we had to wait to get him out and had to wait for his trial to come up.
So going in there as a tourist on that tour.
Yeah.
Versus you going in there and staying there for a period of time, I'm sure that the response from the locals in that area was very different.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, basically, I became like one of them. You know, they kind of accepted me. Obviously, I wasn't a prisoner, so I could come and go. I had an apartment on the outside. And some days, you know, if it got too much, you know, we're living in Thomas had a nice room, but I was sleeping on the floor. And so if every now and then, if we were, you know, just wanted some time out from each other, I would go out of the prison and I could do whatever I want. But, you know, the inmates all knew me. They learn your name, you learn their names, you meet their kids. So it sort of like became, I was never a prisoner. I never had that psychological insight to feeling what it was like to be incarcerated. But it definitely had a big influence on the book in terms of authenticity because, you know, when you hear about this crazy prison system, alcohol, drugs, women, restaurants, you know, there's parties in there. They have rock bands in there, actually, Andy. Maybe there's an opportunity
I've been waiting to tour South America for so many years.
Can we give your band a plug? Let's
insert music now.
Insert Andy Dowling music. So it does sound like a bit of a, you know, not like a prison. It sounds like too light, but it's actually, you know, prison is prison. And once boredom's the main thing you face. Boredom, frustration, just the days tick on. And by the end, I was just desperate to leave, but I couldn't leave because I had to get Thomas out. Yeah. And there's no way I could have published this book ethically if he'd still been in there because there could have easily been reprisals against him.
Absolutely. And did you feel being a foreigner, so to speak, had any disadvantage being in there?
I'd say it has an advantage, you know, for whatever reason, perhaps because of their Spanish colonial history, South Americans tend to be overly respectful, I'd say, almost like look up to white people. They're, you know, they're used to, it's almost like a, if you're a white tourist there, you're not going to get in much trouble. You know, the police won't put you in prison. They just don't mess with you. So you're in a really privileged position going through South America as a white person.
Well, I had a thought the other day, because I started reading your new book, and I was thinking about the stereotypes that a lot of South American countries have with the drug culture and some of the, you know, with the militias and mm-hmm. violence and the dangerous aspects. And when I talk to friends and family and you talk about traveling to these parts of the world, they're like, oh, geez, don't do it. And we sort of, we get sucked into that fear aspect of it.
Mm.
Well, with your books, I mean, that's what you've highlighted, these yeah. stereotypes. But I mean, obviously, it's a reality. It's a stereotype for a reason.
Yeah, that's a good point you've made. I mean, I love Bolivia, and I also love Colombia even more. I think it's Colombia in particular is an amazing culture, beautiful landscapes, wonderful people. They're such happy, resilient people, yeah. very optimistic. Colombians have consistently rated as either the first or second happiest nation in the world, despite all the tragedy and suffering that they've been through. And I really wanted to write a book that did justice to the people and their spirit, but neither can you overlook the incredible human rights abuses, the violence, the cocaine trafficking. Obviously, to an extent, I guess I'm exploiting the negative stereotypes, but I'd like to think my ambition is also to use that as a, I guess, as a draw card for readers wanting to know about war, militia, child soldiers, cocaine trafficking. Those are our salacious, prurient interests in South America, but there's so much more depth there. So I think hopefully those are the things that attract people to begin reading, but when they come out of the book at the other side, they've learnt a great deal about Colombia, Colombian history, the reasons for the war, social injustice, and hopefully they feel inspired and also begin to recognise the link between our behaviour in the West in terms of drug consumption and our drug policies, which have failed drastically in Latin America and caused untold suffering, like horrific torture, human rights abuses, corruption, impediment to economic development. They are paying the highest price for what, you know, Westerners do in terms of their... Westerners are the ones who are consuming drugs, and they're also the ones prosecuting the war on drugs. So it's a kind of a contradiction for South Americans who, in general, I mean, obviously the prison being one exception, but Colombians, all the Colombians I know, don't take cocaine. In fact, most of them have never even seen it. And yet it's the drug which has absolutely decimated their country. So there's a real sad irony there that Colombia is known, you know, in news headlines for kidnap, for cocaine, and for its brutal 50-year war, which has just ended this year, thankfully. So those are the things that, I guess, negative news always travels, yeah. makes better headlines, makes, you know, travels faster. So that's all we ever hear. When there's a positive news story about Colombia, it doesn't tend to make the headlines, with the exception of this peace accord, which is wonderful. I mean, so the war in Colombia started in around the mid-60s with a communist guerrilla. And then about the 70s and particularly through the 80s and 90s, we had their opposition terrorist organization called the paramilitaries or the Alta Defensas.
Yep.
And then you've got the central government and then the American, the US government came in there. So there was really four sides to this war, this horrific war that raged on for decades. And they signed a peace pact with the insurgents earlier this year, and the FARC guerrilla have handed their weapons in, and the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year. So there's hopefully a happy ending, at least a silver lining to the dark clouds in Colombia.
It's I know a few people that have travelled through Colombia, and especially musicians playing shows all through mm-hmm. South America. And I think going back to what you said before about, I guess, the white foreigner, and the perception from locals and the way that those tourists are treated, they had nothing but positive experiences from it. And I think, and it's probably like anywhere in the world, really. I mean, if you look for trouble, you'll find it.
Exactly. And look, you know, it's an unfortunate thing that, you know, there is now a big boom in cocaine tourism throughout mm-hmm. South America. A lot of people just go over there, you know, because it costs whatever, $300-$400 a gram in Australia. And then you can get it for, you know, $5 on the street there. And there's a lot of people go there just to do that. But there's so much more to these cultures. And but you're right, there's lots of bands are going into Colombia. In fact, what they don't play here anymore, but Men at Work have been touring Bolivia for the last like 30 years. That's like one of their biggest fan bases in Bolivia.
I didn't even realize that. Wow.
Like, they're like, I'm like, Men at Work, Land Down Under.
of all the places.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Okay, so the period of time that you were writing, or you'd been at the prison in Bolivia, and then after that had ended and everything had been resolved, you went, you moved to,
relocated to Colombia,
and then you started writing.
Correct. So I moved to Colombia mainly because, you know, I wanted to stay around the Latin American culture and sort of maintain my inspiration. Also, Thomas didn't have a passport, so he couldn't leave the continent. And we needed jobs because we'd spend all our money. We had to bribe Thomas out of the prison, borrow money. My two credit cards were maxed out. My parents were paying off just the interest alone was huge. So I was going further and further into debt, but I needed to be able to support myself whilst writing the book. So I got a job as an English teacher at first, learned Spanish and became a sort of translator. So I was up at night times translating newspapers or embassy documents, working during the day as a, you know, a as an English teacher.
So it wasn't until after you, once you moved to Colombia that you started learning Spanish then?
No, I mean, obviously they speak Spanish throughout the continent, with the exception of Brazil, where they speak Portuguese and some other French-speaking little pockets. But no, I took a few classes and then obviously traveling around that first time for 4 or 5 months, I could speak. But to speak fluently only once I reached Colombia, and really, because there weren't that many foreigners there, and so they don't all speak English. So, and you know, you just, if you want to get a job, if you want to fit into a culture, you've got to learn the local language. That's the only way you can truly understand the culture. Is the first step is learning the language.
Segue. I was reading up about the Australian that was caught earlier this year in Colombia, who's going through the courts at the moment. And I saw that you had been referenced in an article and you made a comment about, and not to go too deeply into it, but there's one little aspect that you mentioned that was quite interesting where about public perception and being in the media and making a lot of noise and having people talk about it all the time and the headlines popping up. But the other thing was for her to actually learn Spanish.
Yeah, definitely. That's your best, you know, that's your best defense against, and also the best way you're going to pass the time easily. It's incredibly intimidating to be locked up in a prison where you can't speak the language. You don't know what's going on around you. You haven't got any friends there. Family's a long way away. So that's definitely, that would be my first recommendation to the young Australian who's been caught in Colombia for attempting to smuggle out, you know, 5.8 kilograms. I've done, I would have done about 25 media appearances just from that.
Because
unfortunately, I don't know if it's a good thing, but you know, I'm now the go-to guy. Whenever anything about Colombia and cocaine comes up, the media call me.
You're the Western subject matter expert.
You know, I went from wanting to be, you know, I'm private school upbringing, wanting to be a playwright to I am the, you know, I'm the cocaine guy. I'm pigeonholing myself a bit here, Andy.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Everyone's going to have their niche. Is it a case that even from a perception point of view and sort of local or cultural respect, if you're making an attempt to learn the language and trying to get a grasp of it, that it gives you, not that it gives you a clear advantage, but obviously from a perception point of view, it's demonstrating good behavior.
Yeah, look, I travel the world a lot and I always, at a minimum, even if you're in the country for 2 days, you know, to learn how to say please and thank you and hello and goodbye. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
And it's just making an effort. I really bristle when I see foreigners, you know, in different countries being disrespectful and going, oh, you know, can't you speak English? And they just walk in and speak English. It's just a natural assumption that our language and our culture is superior and they should learn our language. It's like, hang on, we're in their country.
That's
like,
right.
learn a little, at least learn the minimum, learn some basics just to make the effort, you know, and people open up a lot more when you just even just learn a few words. Hey, how you doing?
I've seen that over the years, in particular, I was in Barcelona last year and we're in the port, and a lot of Brits come in on the cruise ships.
Oh yeah!
And we made the mistake of going to one of the restaurants right on the water there, which is pretty much just
a tourist area.
And just to overhear some of the conversations from people at the tables, trying to order something, and then, you know, the Brits, and I might be a bit unfair, but stereotypically don't have the most adventurous palate for food at times.
I think it depends. You know, Spain. You know, Spain's obviously an easy destination for British travellers. In fact, there was a survey
and 69% of British people said they'd rather live in Spain. Now, I don't know why they don't move down there because it's so close, only like an hour flight. So, look, you do get a different class of tourists going close to home. But in my experience, British are great travellers, and Canadians and Australians. And it just depends, you know, it just depends where you are. If you're just going to a resort, then, you know, you don't always get the people who are really wanting to find out about the culture. They just want, you know, they want some sun, they want some booze, and then they want to go back home. So, if you're traveling to go and live in a culture, understand the culture, immerse yourself in the culture, you avoid those tourist places like plague. You know, I'm really happy that Colombia is now on the map big time for tourism. I think when I was there, there were only about like 1,000 or so tourists going through a year because it was considered to be so dangerous. So we felt that we had the country to ourselves. And the Colombians, when they saw us, they're like, "What are you doing here? Like, this is dangerous." And I'm like, "This is amazing. This is an awesome country." And they were so friendly. And now when I go back, I went back last year to do a documentary called Wildlands, and it was packed. When I went there, there was one hostel in La Candelaria, and now there's 53 in this one suburb. And, you know, when you feel like, and of course, it's very subjective, but when you go to a country and so for your first time, you feel like you've discovered that country. Of course, it's been there for centuries, but you go, it's kind of, you feel a sense of ownership almost. And then when you see other people there, you go, "Oh, you shouldn't be here. You're just a tourist," right? Which is, it's a total hypocrisy, double standard. But yeah, when I see people just flooding into Colombia and going there for the drugs, you know, that's really disappointing for me.
Oh, I find that with Japan. The first time that we went there, 15 odd years ago, and for 10 days that we were there, we saw one other Caucasian person in that entire time. And we went through the three major cities, and it was incredible. We stood out, and we'd never experienced hospitality like the Japanese. Mm. And everyone's really courteous, and everyone would just go out of their way for you, even if they didn't want to. Yeah. They demonstrated that helpfulness. And then the consecutive years that went past there, and in Australia opening Japan opening the doors and cheap flights over there and whatnot.
Yeah.
Every year you went back, you just saw more and more, more and more Australians, and you're like, "Oh, get out of here."
It's a total double standard, because we are still tourists, right? Yeah. But you sort of feel like, "Oh, because you might know a bit more about the culture, you've been there before, that you kind of have the right to be there, but other tourists don't." But yeah, I mean, there's parts of Africa and Asia as well where they just, you know, they see white skin, they just come up and touch you, or they come up and just follow you or stare at you. You know, it's really weird, and they haven't seen a white person ever, and they're just looking at you going, "Wow, blue eyes."
It's like an alien. It's yeah, incredible.
It's an incredible experience as well. You feel like, you feel like you're an extraterrestrial.
So do you actually own a place over in Colombia now?
I've still got a house over there. Yeah. When I was leaving, I really wanted to do something nice for the country, and 10% of my royalties from Colombiano go to helping children affected by violence to a foundation called the Colombian Children's Foundation. You can find that online at colombianchildrensfoundation.org.au. So that charity works with local organisations, and one of the organisations, local Colombian charities, I have allowed them to use my house as their head office. And so they work with a lot of former child soldiers who are coming out of the war, who need, you know, love and support. And they do drama workshops, music, pottery, just teaching these kids to be kids again. Mm. So I do have a house, but it's occupied as a charity at the moment.
That's a great thing to do, especially when you think about international investors buying up property and then it sits there vacant and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a great purpose. It was a nice thing to do, but at the same time, I come back to Sydney and I'm 42, and it sounds like I'm complaining, but you know, at the moment, I'm living on a mattress on my dad's floor, right? because of the way I've lived my life. Like, I love traveling. And you just need a roof over your head. But Sydney is just so incredibly expensive, unfortunately. Now, I can't afford to live here, right? Even though I'm an international bestseller, right now I cannot afford to live in Sydney.
It's ridiculous here. Mm. It's just, I mean, even for myself personally, I've had to buy a house 2 hours south down the south coast just to get a foot in the door, and then work myself out after that, and maybe creep back up the coast or creep elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it's yeah,
it's a struggle for young people, you know, really hard.
Absolutely. So fast forwarding a little bit, you eventually got to the point where the book came out, Marching Powder came out, did really well. And then the next chapter sort of came along where you've started doing this extra work and working with the US.
Yeah, so
and
I was...
this is sort of leading into...
Marching Powder came out June 2003, and I went back to Colombia. By that stage, I was in love with the country. I thought it was just amazing. I just said, this is my home. This is my spiritual home. I found my passion, my inspiration. I really wanted to write another book, and it was going to be about Colombia. I didn't yet know the exact focus, but I went back to continue working as an English teacher just to get some money through the door and just to start interviewing people. I was writing little vignettes and just trying to work out what exactly I want to write about. On one of my flights back into the country through Miami, I met a guy in an airport who was in his late 40s. He was wearing a suit and tie. He didn't speak Spanish, and I was like, what are you doing going down to Colombia? He just sort of looked a bit suspicious, and he claimed that he was in construction. And he was a lovely guy, and he's become a really good friend and mentor to me. And that meeting with Thomas, that 1 hour tour with Thomas, changed my life. Like, it totally changed my life. And this was the second time this has happened to me in such a big way. So this guy on the plane, and we became friends. He took me out to dinner a few times. We had a few beers, and then he sort of said, well, you know, why are you an English teacher? You know, you've got a law degree, a commerce degree. Why don't you, you know, come work for us? And I was like, doing what? And he said, well, get up 6 o'clock tomorrow morning and I'll pick you up. And he picked me up in a bulletproof car and took me to a US counterterrorism base that was under construction in Colombia. And he said, we do construction, but we just construct, you know, counterterrorism bases. So rifle ranges, pistol ranges, shoot house, all the accommodation, all the logistics and camp management for counterterrorism bases around the world. And they needed someone to be their program manager. So the program itself was called AKI, which is Anti-Kidnapping Initiative. Colombia, unfortunately, had the dubious reputation, the dubious honor of being the country with the highest kidnap rate in the world. So at the peak, there were between 3,000 and 4,000 kidnaps per year, and that averages out to be about 8 or 9, sometimes 10 people per day. And you can imagine, just even if one person were kidnapped in Australia or UK or wherever, or the US, that would be national headlines. But, you know, there were just so many that it was just became normalized and desensitized. And the population was living in fear. People wouldn't use the roads at nighttime. Wealthy people would live in gated communities. High-rise apartments always had guards with guns down the stairs and CCTV everywhere. So it was a real fortress mentality when I was there. And this program aimed to change that. So they used special forces, people from the US military, contractors essentially, and from the British military as well, SAS. And they came down and they trained up and equipped and armed the local SWAT teams that were, you know, they were already very experienced and professional soldiers, but they lacked the advanced weaponry. So that was one, and the advanced training. So that was what the program was about. There were 32 departamentos or provinces in Colombia. Each of them has one of these local SWAT teams dedicated to stopping kidnaps and extortion. So we were, you know, sort of financing them, equipping them, giving them uniforms, bullets, grenades, explosives, and training.
What was your reaction when you walked in and realized what this all was?
I freaked out. I was like, oh, is this a trap? Like, why me? What have I done here? Am I being set up for something? I just, you know, but I mean, the guy was really nice. This gentleman was a really nice guy. And, you know, I trusted him, and he put a lot of faith in me because I was 28 at the time. So I was pretty young to be in that area. And obviously, and I was, you know, in a management position at the age of 28 around, you know, experienced soldiers. And it was the best job I've ever had. And I really, you know, at first I had a bit of a dilemma going, well, this is US government. It's a military. I'm generally a fairly peaceful person. And I certainly, the world would be, to my mind, the world would be a great place if no guns ever existed. But unfortunately, you know, when you have terrorist organizations trying to overthrow a central government, you have to defend yourself. So, and when I saw what this particular program was doing, which was rescuing people who had been chained in the jungle by the neck and held in barbed wire cages, forced to trek around the jungle so that the government couldn't rescue them, fed on a diet of rice and beans and lentils, and, you know, deprived of sunlight and medical care and no contact with their loved ones, you know, just and not knowing what their fate would be. That's just such an horrific, inhumane crime. Again, it's just one of the most debased things that you can do as a human. And you know, basically this program, along with other government, Colombian government initiatives backed by the US, really turned the country around, and kidnaps are down to, on average, one a day now. It's still one too many, but it made a massive difference. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're pro-US or communist, or it doesn't matter. I don't think it matters what your politics are. There's just no justification, to my mind, for kidnapping people and holding a gun to the head and saying, how much do you want to pay for your loved one back? So I was, you know, I was skeptical at first and a little bit apprehensive, but ultimately quite proud of being, you know, I was only a small wheel in all this. I'm not claiming any grand heroism in all this. I was one person who was, you know, part of a big program and part of a big government initiative to really turn the country around. And they did that. It's a wonderful country. And as I said before, now tourists are flooding in and it's so much safer.
Was that when you were first exposed? Well, I mean, no doubt, I'm sure that you already knew about kidnappings and especially child kidnappings being sort of a highlight, but was it only when you started being exposed to this organisation that you really started to understand the reality behind it and what some of these, especially the children, are having to go through?
Yeah, so look, I'd already been in the country for a few years by then. Obviously, I could speak Spanish. I'd already interviewed people around the world, so I knew. I guess I knew quite a bit about everything in theory.
Yeah,
but working, you know, closely with the police and military in the US and being around guns, it really was just the closest you could get to the war without being in the war yourself.
Yep.
So it was, you know, it's like really deep firsthand research and interviews. And also the contacts that I had there gave me access to far higher level interviewees. And I obviously knew, when I first went to Colombia, I didn't know there were child soldiers in Colombia at all. In fact, Human Rights Watch estimates that at the peak of the war, there were between 11 and 14,000 children involved in the civil war. I didn't know about that. We all hear about child soldiers coming from Africa, but very few people are aware that Colombia had so many child soldiers. So that quickly became my focus, because my heart went out to these kids. And as I started interviewing them and hearing about the horrific treatment they received in these terrorist organizations, I just went, look, the world needs to know about this. And yeah, I could have written it as journalism, as sort of dry statistics, but when you start talking about 11, 14,000 kids or 3,000 people kidnapped per year, you're just overwhelmed. It's just a number.
So
to my mind, if you're writing just facts and figures and statistics, it's so dry, people lose the human element of it. And so I wanted to really write a sort of personalized account of, you know, told from the perspective of these child soldiers. It's fictionalized. It's a fiction book, Colombiano, but the factual setting and the historical period is very accurate.
Yeah, I've just started reading it, and I'm halfway through that first, because there's a number of stories in there, from what I can see. So I'm on that first story, and I think there's like a few chapters around that story. It's where the son and his father are, and like, spoiler alert.
Chapter one, spoiler alert.
Yeah, that's right. The father and the son are burying the farmer.
Yeah.
And they're going through all that process, and he's becoming an adult himself. And then it's getting to that point, I think, where I've literally just ended at the moment, where he's getting to a point where he realizes he's got to choose a side because he's just got no choice.
It's unfortunate, you know, and that's sort of one of the themes is, you know, and of this book is, you know, if you don't choose a side, one will be chosen for you, one will be picked for you. The Colombian government didn't have full control over the country. Probably about between 30 and 40% of the national territory of Colombia was in the hands of one or other of these terrorist organizations. In fact, there are two main ones, but in fact, there are about four or five splinter groups. And so if you're living in the areas controlled by these terrorist organizations, they are the de facto government. You do what they say, or they come around and visit you with guns. And they control the economy, they control people's social life, they control the laws effectively. Everyone has to live under their tyranny. And you can try and oppose it, but you'll end up losing your life. So basically, you either join them or you join the opposition. And there's very limited scope for being neutral. There are some very brave people who maintain neutrality, but often they will become targeted just by virtue of saying, I refuse to choose a side, and they can be killed for not choosing a side.
I think the example or the aspect of that first story where they're talking about the taxes that need to be paid to the guerrillas just reminds me of the Red Army in China having to go through each province and taxing the locals to ensure that they've got protection or whatever it might be.
Effectively, you know, it's sort of like the mafia, right? So the... You know, because terrorist organizations are actually quite expensive to fund, you know, you got a standing army, the FARC at its peak was, they estimate between 17 and 20,000 soldiers, making it the biggest standing insurgency in the Western Hemisphere. Imagine feeding those people, buying rifles, bullets, all the logistical aspects of keeping an army fed and moving around. They need money. And also, because the government wasn't there, so the terrorist organizations would charge 10% tax on everything, and they basically, that was how they financed themselves, along with, that was extortion, kidnapping was another, and cocaine trafficking was a very lucrative source of funding for them as well.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of similarities in a number of different countries with organizations.
Well, we're seeing that with ISIS, and one of the things with ISIS in particular is that they are, it's not just a political or religious movement, it's also they're highly integrated into the economy. So that's they become actually part of the fabric of society. It's very difficult to root them out. Yeah, so Colombia, you had to pay 10%. It's a vacuna. They call it a vaccination. But effectively, it was a tax. And their argument, they had some pretty logical arguments. And it was, we are providing protection. We are the de facto government. If the government were here, they would be charging you taxes. So we're just charging you taxes if we're the government. So that was their kind of...
opportunists.
That was their rationale. But you see that same rationale by standover groups and mafias, and the Italian mafia always paid. You're paying us money to protect you, but in fact you're really just paying the money to protect you from them.
it's such a foreign thing for people like us living in Sydney and Australia in the Western world, for the most part, where we're not really exposed to a lot of
We don't realize how lucky we are, you know, when you see, you know, a corruption scandal, or if someone in government has taken a bribe, or a policeman has been involved in drug trafficking. Those are really isolated incidents, and those to me are indications that we have a wonderful government and we have a wonderful police force and a really honest society. And it's good. I mean, it's good that obviously any corrupt incidents get exposed in the media and actions are taken, but it's an indicator of how amazingly functional Australian society is, and how, you know, how fair it has been historically. I think it's becoming less fair and less egalitarian than previously, but it's still an amazingly civilized country we live in.
Do you think as a result that we're a lot more disconnected from some of the other realities?
Yeah, I mean, people are geared, our brains are naturally wired to look for stress and look for problems. And so when your basic needs are being met, whether it's security, roof over your head, you start to look for new problems, you know, so
like
people...
Facebook feed.
Yeah, so people develop kind of anxieties about, oh, am I attractive? Yep. You know, am I successful enough? Do my friends like me? You know, do I look good in this Instagram photo? These are all first world problems, because the other more basic problems of being fed and clothed and, you know, the difficulties, the satisfaction of basic needs that still plague and confront other developing nations just aren't present in our lives. So we're like, oh, this is the most important thing right now. I want to be seen in this nightclub or sipping a soy latte at this cafe. Look at me. And, you know, there's a whole set of anxieties that we invent for ourselves because we're not really struggling.
Was that ever a conflict for you coming from, I guess, your upbringing and living here and knowing that, I guess, there was a better life, so to speak, where you had the comforts at home and you could always go back there, but you were putting yourself through that adversity?
I mean, I guess it kind of seems like a perverse thing to do, but I actually feel a lot more alive when I'm around that dynamic. And I think you see a lot more extremes of human behavior. And that's always, I've always been fascinated by people. But I think, you know, wealth and, but essentially wealth and civilization can provide a kind of a mask or a buffer for what we're really like. So when you see, I know when I feel more passion and inspiration living in countries where people are struggling, and it brings out different sides of your character. It's, you know, it's ironical, as I said before, that, you know, say Australia has quite a high suicide rate given our material wealth, and countries like Colombia actually have low suicide rates, and as I said, consistently rate as the happiest countries in the world. So it's kind of a perverse facet of human society that when you're struggling, with basic things, you haven't got time to invent problems for yourself. You know, you haven't got problems to go, why am I here? You haven't got the existentialist angst and going, oh, who am I? I'm a failure. They don't think about those things in those countries. They're just struggling to stay alive.
Yeah, it's such a disconnect for so many people. I mean, I'm like that myself. And even coming here today thinking, what do I know about South America? I've never been there. What do I know about, that drug culture and the cartels and the guerrilla armies and the child soldiers and the kidnappings? And so for me, I'm an outsider.
Yeah.
For you, you know more and you've had exposure to it, but then you've probably felt like that as an outsider to them as well.
Yeah, exactly. And look, and obviously I'm flicking between the two cultures. Like it takes me a while to readjust when I go to Colombia and reintegrate there. And then I come back to, you know, beautiful Mossman in Sydney and go, wow, it's a culture shock. And I love both. I love both sides, but it's amazing how in one planet there are just so many different cultures and different ways of living. And it's always a bit of a shock when you flip from one to the next.
I bet.
I love traveling for that reason. You just get such a broad understanding of humans, because we're all essentially the same. We all essentially want the same things. The basic needs. You want love. You want recognition. You want friendship. You want... where you want to achieve your goals, and those are universal things, and yet it plays out in just dramatically different dynamics around the world in different cultures.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's definitely something that keeps you on your toes, and that feeling of being outside your comfort zone. I mean, I've felt that so many times, being somewhere and just going, do I walk out the front door today? Like you've got that apprehension where you know that you're going to have not so much a difficult conversation, but a frustrating conversation with somebody because of a language gap or a cultural gap, or, you know, where do I eat? And those things that are so trivial and might seem petty, but it's a human challenge to try and overcome initially, because you're literally outside of your comfort zone.
Well, that's part of the reason I love traveling, is to kind of, you actually learn a lot about yourself, and you're challenging yourself constantly. You're constantly learning. But I think, you know, sometimes in Western societies, we have things too easy, and that actually can breed discontent and boredom, you know. And so that was my primary, I guess, feeling growing up, was there's got to be more to life than what, even though I had so much, I wasn't necessarily happy with it. And it wasn't until I went to, you know, poorer nations, developing nations, where they were facing an entirely different gamut of entirely different problems, that I went, wow, I'm actually really, really lucky. And I learned
perspective.
I got different perspective. I learned to appreciate what I had, whereas I didn't when I was growing up with such privileges.
Yeah, definitely. So going back to starting this work with as a contractor and working with this US program to sort of upskill and provide training for Colombian soldiers military
and police.
How far along in that process did you actually, because I know that you said when you're going back to Colombia you wanted to write something and you didn't know what it was, did you have that light bulb moment almost straight away that you go, I know what I need to write about? Or was that something that sort of came later on down the track as you immerse yourself into that?
Even before I started working for this program, I was already interviewing loads of people, you know, involved around in and around the war. I thought, look, it's basically impossible to write something about Colombia without the context of the war, because it just permeated everyone's life for five decades. So I was already interviewing people, and then obviously the angle and my perspective changed quite dramatically when I was, you know, started looking at it from the army side. I probably would have written a completely different story, and perhaps one which is less empathetic, if I'd just looked at it from an outsider's point of view. Maybe I would take the side and say, these guys are definitely the bad guys. But when you start talking to one side and then you start speaking to the other side, you begin to gain an understanding that there's, you know, it's so much more complex. You know, I won't say there's no right or wrong, but there's certainly different ways of looking at the same issues. And it's not until you try to understand as many perspectives as you can that you can write a decent book, I think, with some depth and some real understanding.
And was that one of the reasons why you chose to go down that fiction fictional path?
Yeah, like, I mean, there was a practical issue as well, and that was that most people were really scared and they wouldn't go on the record, and they certainly wouldn't give their names, and they wouldn't give permission to write a book about them or to mention them in a book because they were afraid of reprisals. So I had it would be difficult to write a non-fiction book about someone who was anonymous, and also there were just so many interviewees whose stories I wanted to include, and whose I wanted to weave them all together, but they didn't know each other. They weren't necessarily connected in real life. So I might meet one person in one part of the country who had an amazing story, and then another person in another part of the country that had a different story at a different period of time. So how do you combine all these anonymous stories into...
And try and give it an identity.
And give it a story arc, something that's going to drive it along and make people want to read. And if I'd just kept to these little vignettes, it would have been very, very disjointed. So with the help of Simone Camilleri, who was my then girlfriend, she's now my literary agent and story consultant.
I was going to ask you about the story consultant. I think that's an interesting title.
Yeah, well, most people don't understand how books get written. Yeah. Fiction in particular I found really challenging. But so non-fiction, obviously, you're limited to the telling the truth. You have to stick to the facts. Yeah. And that might sound frustrating, but actually in some ways makes it easier because you can't deviate. Whereas fiction, on the other hand, you know, you have to use your imagination. You have to go to the limits. And so story consultants are quite common for writers script writers in Hollywood. And basically the people who help you tease out a story, identify weaknesses in the storyline, develop characters. So Simone was really instrumental, for example, in saying, well, what about females' perspective? You know, so my female characters tended to be fairly flat, one-dimensional, you know, the mother, the girlfriend, and I didn't really delve into their perspective. And she really said, well, how do you think his girlfriend feels? How do you think his mother feels? Why don't you put her emotions in there? So story consultants are really valuable if you can find a good one. And Simone was really incredible. She did, you know, she worked for free at the time basically, and just as a friend because she believed in my talent and really helped develop me as a writer.
Is that the first time that you've dived into sort of fictional writing, or have you had cracks at it before?
Obviously my first book was Marching Powder. I'd never attempted a piece that long. I'd written short stories at school and at university. I won one or two sort of small prizes, you know, the New South Wales University Literary Prize. So I knew I could write okay, but there's a big difference between writing a thousand word essay or a thousand word short story and writing a novel that's, you know, this one's like 200 and something thousand words. You know,
yeah, it's a thick book.
Yeah, it's a brick. It's a multicolored brick, Andy. That's what I call it. But luckily it's got quite big font, so people shouldn't be turned off just by the size of it. You know, you can get through it and hopefully the pace sustains your interest. And that's it. I mean, it doesn't matter the length or the size of the book. It's whether it's interesting and whether the pace pulls you along and whether you want to find out what comes next.
Yeah, absolutely. So from sitting down, obviously you spent a long time collating information and interviewing people and trying to get, even to begin with, before you got your angle, investing a lot of time getting that content together. But the point where you sat down and had all this content and tried to sort of mash it together and work out how it's going to be structured. How long was that process before you had that first draft together?
The first draft of this story. I mean, the original book was three times as long, and it had three different stories. Let's call them A, B, and C. And I was like, I'm never going to get this book done. I was way too ambitious. I didn't really know how to limit the scope. So I started concentrating on the C book and. The first draft of that was completed in about 2012. But overall, from research and to this final book hitting the shelves, you know, it had been 12, 13 years, which is a long time to be staring at a computer screen, a long time to keep yourself motivated. It didn't have, you know, there's no one patting you on the back. There's no one looking over your shoulder going, yeah, what you're doing is good. There's no, you know, I didn't have a deadline. So, you know, for a long time, I really felt I was sort of lost out at sea. And then luckily Simone in particular was really instrumental, as was the editors and staff at Random House.
I guess that would have been probably a big driver, because I just think about anything that I do, and if I can't see the end goal within like a short space of time, I lose focus.
You lose perspective. Yeah. Oh,
absolutely.
I got rather depressed as well, because you're just like, I assumed, you know, wow, I had an international bestseller with my first book. It took about a year or 4 months to research and about a year to write. So I was like, you know, I can do this. I've done it the first time. I've done it once. This is going to be easy.
Yeah.
And I did not envisage that I would be 42 when my book came out. I thought I'd, you know, I started it in my 30s.
A few books in by then.
It took my entire 30s to write this. This was a decade project, decade long project.
I can't even wrap my head around that. But I mean, that's that. I always crap on to friends about delayed gratitude and
delayed gratification.
Yeah, that's it. Gratification. And, and I think that's an extreme example of that.
It is. And look, you know, my gratification levels are pretty high now, because I'm, you know, it's actually, you know, I guess I'm proud of having finished it, but I'm just, more than anything, I'm just relieved. And you're like, it ended up, started off as inspiration, and then became, towards the end, it became a burden to me, like a real, like, how am I going to get this done? And what if I don't get it done? And what if people don't like it? Imagine spending 10 years of your life doing something, and then at one stage the publisher said, this is unpublishable. And that, so I was like, what? I've spent 10 years doing something, and it's never going to see the light of day. You imagine how depressing that is, how it was absolutely, just an absolute shock to me. I went into a tailspin when they gave me that first feedback. They said, we can't publish this. And then luckily, you know, Simone came along and the editors came along at Random House and really helped me chop it into shape. But even then, it still took another year or two to get it finished.
So I read somewhere, there was an article where you mentioned that you were working like 16 hours a day at one point. I don't know at what stage of the book, but did you have routines in place to try and keep yourself going?
Or yeah, was it definitely.
Just dive in?
Yeah, definitely. So the point where I think you've only got maybe, look, maximum 4, 5, 6, if you're lucky, creative hours in a day, but not all of writing is creative. Some of it's sort of housekeeping stuff and revision. The point where I was doing 16, 18 hour days was because I was working on a documentary at the same time, and I had a deadline for both of them. So I was just literally 7 days a week up for 18, sometimes 20 hours a day, and I was just a zombie. And I started smoking, you know, e-cigarettes and stuff just to keep myself awake. And it's it's most of writing, I say, more than skill or intelligence or talent, is self-discipline. You know, it's basically forcing yourself to get up and sit in front of a computer screen on your own and draw, you know, creativity out of your brain. And so it's an incredibly difficult thing to do day after day after day, and to retain your inspiration. I have nothing but the utmost respect for it. The other writers who perhaps write more commercial stuff but release a book every year, I'm like, hats off to you people. I mean, I don't read the more commercial writers. I think, you know, I'd much rather write, you know, 2 or 3 really good books in my lifetime, and that's it. But the people who can just put out a book every year, that's incredible discipline.
Oh, it's just, I think just even, like, I look at, I have this ongoing fascination about being a drawer or a sketch artist and being able to create something visually. And I start it and it's crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I chuck the pad off to the side, and the pen's over in a basket somewhere. And then I come back 6 months later, and then
do it again.
Yeah, and
I think it was.
There must be days like that where you start off, and whatever you're writing is just like, oh my god, this is it.
So basically, Ernest Hemingway said the first draft of anything is shit, right? So if you'd seen, like, I'd say Colombiano is probably on its fifth iteration, like its fifth draft.
Yeah.
To get to that standard. And if I look back at the first draft, which I thought was good at the time, I go, geez, that was terrible. So it really is a case of, doesn't matter, even if you're having a bad day and what you're writing is crap, and it will always be the crap the first time. Yeah. You just got to keep writing. You've just got to keep producing that material, because the alternative is to go, I won't write unless I'm writing really well, and then you produce nothing. And a lot of people sort of have it in them that they want to write a book, and they go, keep putting it off. But you've just got to get and just produce something every day, even if it's low quality, and then just improve it.
Well, I think you're a prime example of somebody that's just stuck to it, and there's no, it's the old cliche, it's a marathon, not a sprint or a race. It's just,
it's an absolute marathon. It's been the love of my life and the bane of my existence, Andy. So it's, I'm glad to have come through it, and I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I just want to sleep for a month, I think.
I was going to ask that. I mean, I think you must be still in the whirlwind of obviously launching the book and and getting around the country and whatnot. Are you doing international stuff as well? Or?
Yeah, so the aim is to release it in the UK, the US, and hopefully get it translated. In the meantime, as I mentioned, I was doing a documentary called Wildlands. Right, that was 5 months full time. It's an amazing, amazing documentary.
Is that out now?
It's an amazing documentary by a guy called Colin Offland. Yep. He's the director. He's a really good guy. And we teamed up and I was the narrator presenter and we went around interviewing some fascinating characters in South America and the US. And that should come out in the next few weeks. And that's international as well. That's going into, I think, 11 foreign languages. Yeah. So that will be around the world. And
I saw the trailer for that.
It's really out of control. Like, it really is amazing. I love
who's that hitman guy that the most dangerous person in South America?
No, I wouldn't quite say that.
One of them.
Yeah, he was Pablo Escobar's chief assassin, and he was he just got out of prison, and he was responsible for killing 3,000 people. 3,000. And these guys, I mean, this is the Medellin cartel under Pablo Escobar. They blew up a plane with killed 110 people in an attempt to assassinate a Colombian presidential candidate who wasn't even on the plane then, but they just blew the plane up anyway. They killed thousands of police, just horrific tortures. And this guy was, in amongst the thick of it. And he was a cold-blooded killer. I interviewed him. I interviewed the guy played by Johnny Depp in the movie Blow.
Yep.
If you remember that movie from 1996, his name's George Young. So he was one of the primary importers of cocaine for the Medellin cartel into the west coast of the United States, into California, essentially. And he was just out of prison. I interviewed him. Interviewed Thomas McFadden, the guy from Marching Powder. We went back inside the prison 15 years later as older men.
Jeez. And stood for bit of a time warp.
It was surreal. The tours have now been banned. Right after he left, it all sort of collapsed, and obviously Marching Powder exposed it, and the government sort of shut it down. I do hear from time to time of tourists getting in there, but there are no sort of formal tours anymore. Yeah. We went into the prison, and the only inmates who were still there were the ones who were in for murder, so they recognised us. And we were sort of trying to keep a very low profile while we were filming inside illegally. And then when we came out, they've got guided walking tours of the city of La Paz. When we came out, there were 50 tourists standing outside the prison with a tour guide at the front pointing to the prison going, "This is the prison, San Pedro prison, made famous by Marching Powder, the book by Rusty Young and Thomas McFadden." And we were just going, "What?" And we actually joined this tour, like, just incognito.
Oh, well.
We joined this tour listening to people talk about our book and our experience, and just thought, what a trip, two guys who met one day, just friends, decided to write a book, and 15 years later, the people are doing tours about it. And it's just, it was quite a surreal experience.
That's incredible. Just touching on, so what was the hitman's name?
His proper name is John Jairo Velasquez Vasquez, and his nickname was Popeye or Popeye.
And you personally interviewed him for that documentary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was his first interview with her. I think at the time, he's now been interviewed by a few people, but that was one of the first times that he'd been interviewed by a Western journalist.
I think there's something in the trailer about this, because I watched it a couple of months ago, but something about just the lead up to speaking with this guy.
Oh, yeah.
It just seems like there must have been some real apprehension to...
Yeah, I mean, I'd never met him before. I knew exactly who he was, and this guy's killed 3,000 people, right? And so I didn't know, and I was like, how is he alive as well? Because if you've killed that many people, you've got a lot of enemies, and he's got to be keeping where he's living a secret. He's got to be on the move. He's got to be fearful of assassination. So I wasn't fearful that he was going to do anything to me, because he wanted to tell his story. He's now written books, and he's trying to get a Netflix series up about his life. But I was fearful that, if I was sitting there with him in public space, that someone might come around and shoot him, right? Because how is this guy still alive, So I did, before the interview, I rang him and I was sort of saying, where are we going to meet? Where are we going to do this? And are you going to be bringing a gun? you know, and I had some of my, I'd rung some of my police contacts and said, I think I might need you guys to come and be my bodyguards. And he had his, Sicario, like his, you know, motorbike assassins there hanging back with guns. And we had, our protection there with guns, and we had all this expensive film equipment. And obviously it draws attention, and he's known, his face is known there because of all the crimes he's committed there. So we're filming and everyone's looking at us. So I'm just, it was hairy.
And how long did that whole process take of doing the interview?
We conducted that over a day in multiple locations. We just sort of stayed on the move in Medellin, Colombia. So I really got to know him pretty well. And he's, you know, he's a proper, you know, he was charming. He was really bright, really articulate, and really, you know, I won't say likable, but just he's endearing. He's really engaging, speaks really quickly. And he's very direct, so there's a certain charm, but he's a total psychopath. Like, he's completely unrepentant about killing people, almost proud of it. And, you know, there was a real dilemma there for me as well, because, you know, we all like stories of, you know, corruption and cartels and, you know, violence and experiences outside our own purview. But there's a risk that when you start to give people who have had, you know, horrific criminal backgrounds, give them too much media play, then you sort of make them into heroes.
Yeah.
And there's a real fine line between, you know, journalism and exposing the story and getting to know who these people are and why they do what they do, and also heroicizing their criminal acts, which have caused incredible levels of suffering.
Do you worry about, I guess, yourself and your own reputation now with having two books and the documentary, and being, as you mentioned before, this person that's referred to whenever there's something that goes wrong in sort of the drug world in South America? Going back there, do you ever consider?
I certainly won't go back to Bolivia. Obviously I've written a controversial book about Bolivia. I'm not very popular with the government there. I think Colombia won't be unsafe, because they've now got the peace process has been signed off on. But, you know, if you're a journalist and you're making statements about a country, then you you just want to keep a low profile for a little while and stay out of the country. I'm not fearful. I mean, I never intended to be the kind of go-to guy for cocaine stories or cartel stories, but it just happened to be over there at an interesting period in the continent's history, and Colombia's history in particular. And that was what was fascinating to me. I delved deeply into that world, but I'd like to use those same, the same techniques, the same skill set to apply it to different stories. And I don't want to be pigeonholed as the guy who writes about cocaine.
Yeah, absolutely. Has anybody in Colombia read any of the books so far? Has it been any reaction?
I've had a few people who I worked with over there going, because I didn't tell anyone I was working for the US government, right? Yeah. So it's friends, you know, friends of really long standing, 15 year standing, going, I just read in the media that you worked for the US government. You know, they felt a bit kind of betrayed. And
friends in Colombia?
Yeah, friends in Colombia.
So what did you tell them when you were?
I was in construction.
Amazing.
So,
but you had no choice, didn't you? You couldn't.
Well, no, I wasn't undercover, I wasn't a spy or anything, but it was just more like for your own protection. You just don't want to go around announcing that. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. I had a bulletproof vehicle, changed houses all the time, you know, had long hair, short hair, just dressed down, just kept a low profile. And that was part of the job, was just keeping your mouth shut and being discreet. And that meant not telling. I was living with a girl at the time, and I didn't tell her. So when I did finally tell her, she felt like, you know, I'd been lying to her. And, you know, I had been, but I was doing it, I guess, for the right reasons. But it's also, it's not a good way to live. I don't, you know, I really, as I said, I wasn't a spy. But when I see movies about people who lie, you know, because of their job or their career path, I do feel a lot of empathy towards them, because they're doing it for the right reasons. But you're also lying to the people you love around you. So it's a really difficult way to conduct your life, particularly if you're an honest and open person, which I like to think I am, but I guess everyone does.
No, absolutely. Well, I'm conscious of the time, but the book's out now.
Yep, Colombiano.
I've brought my copy along so I can get a little bit of a personalised scribble in there from yourself.
Sure.
But
do you want me to sign your guitar as well?
Oh, I didn't bring that next time. But I'll put links up so people can go and purchase the book. I'll work out where the best places are, but I got one through Booktopia, so that seems to be a good a good spot.
Yeah, it's on iBooks, Booktopia for the ebook format, Amazon, I think, and then obviously all the wonderful Australian retailers, most bookstores around the country are stocking Colombiano and Marching Powder.
Sounds good. And Wildlands is out in a couple of weeks, yep. So I'll put links up once that's out.
Thanks, Andy.
You can check that out. But that's really cool. But wow, I feel a little bit more enlightened. Thank you, mate.
Thank you. Great questions, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks.
Enjoyed awesome. Your program. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, folks. If you want to check out Rusty's stuff, I'm going to have everything over at andysocial.net. You can purchase the first book, Marching Powder, which I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, and obviously Rusty has spoken about in this episode itself, and his new book, Colombiano, as well. So I'm going to have everything over in the show notes, andysocial.net. As with all the previous guests on my episode, I've got my bird in the background just screeching. So if you can hear that, it's my brand new cockatiel called Larry Burb. Yes, Larry Burb. Anyway, moving along, everything's going to be over at andysocial.net, so be sure to check that out. As always, housekeeping. If you want to support the podcast, go over to my website. You can click on the Amazon portal link if you regularly shop through Amazon. By clicking through that affiliate link, I get a small commission of whatever you buy. Don't worry, if you buy anything sus, I don't know who it is. I don't know what you buy. I just get a nice little commission at the end of it, so don't stress. I've also got a PayPal button on there, so if you ever want to fling me 50 cents or a dollar or whatever it might be, feeling generous, want to get warm and fuzzy, do that. It's there for you to use or not. Most importantly, you're listening to this episode and you're listening to me carry on now. That means the most to me. So thank you so much as always. If you want to support the band, lord.net.au, you can find Lord on all of the social media platforms. Yes, it's a very crap word in order to do searches for. So if you type Lord Metal or Lord Australia Metal or Lord Band, you'll find us. Don't worry, we're all over the place. So if you want to check us out, do that. Plug, plug, plug. All right, guys, that's enough. Enjoy. Thank you so much. And I'll be back next week with another great episode. Great episode, if I do say so myself, of the Antisocial Podcast. Take care, guys. Bye-bye. You're antisocial.